end of the room, an open book on the table in front of him. By the dark look on his face, it was more than clear he'd heard the entire conversation. "You said you would protect him." Was there really no one in the entire League I could trust? These people couldn't be counted on for anything. All of their promises bled into lies. Cole shook his head, turning his palms face up on the table. It was a weak, silent apology, but at least he understood. Shifting this one single piece on the board was enough to change the whole game. 6. They smuggled Jude and me into Boston in broad daylight, riding in the jump seats of a fat-bellied cargo plane. It was an older model than the one we'd used to fly back from Philadelphia, and its smell lent some possibility to Jude's theory it had once been used to move dead meat. I watched the enormous crates in front of us, trying to ignore the way they creaked under the strain of the straps holding them in place. All of them were marked with Leda Corporation's elegant golden swan, which felt like some kind of horrible wink from the universe. The rational part of me knew it didn't mean anything, that it wasn't some bad omen. We flew on Leda Corp's planes all the time. They'd realized the benefit of playing nice with both Gray and the Federal Coalition, which meant they had special privileges to travel to and from California to move their product. As uncooperative as always, Gray had the brilliant idea to try to starve the Federal Coalition out of California by forbidding imports into the state and exports out of it. Unfortunately for the rest of the country, California was where most of the fresh produce was, and they had easy access to the oil they were drilling in Alaska. The Federal Coalition was our matchmaker, though. We got to piggyback on flights like this in exchange for serving as their knife in the dark. Alden saw it as a fair trade for the intelligence we'd gathered and countless ops we'd run on their behalf over the years, though I knew he wanted more. Specifically, respect, money, and the promise that he'd be given a place in their new government once Gray was out. On the other side of the plastic-wrapped heap of crates was Beta Team, laughing at some joke that had been lost to the steady snarl of the engines. I pressed the backs of my freezing hands against my eyes, trying to ease the throbbing there. What little heat was still circulating in the cargo space must have been clinging to the ceiling, because I felt exactly none of it. I sank down lower in my seat, wrapping the black puffer coat as tightly around my center as I could with the seatbelt in the way. "Deep breath in," Jude was chanting. "Deep breath out. Deep breath in. Deep breath out. You are not in an airplane. You are floating through the sky. Deep breath in." "I think you actually have to be taking deep breaths for that to work," I told him. The plane dipped, only to bob up a second later. "Is that..." His voice cracked. "Was that normal?" "It's just a little turbulence," I told him, trying to pull away from his grip. "It happens on every flight." Jude had strapped a TACT team member's helmet to his head and a pair of goggles over his eyes. I didn't have the heart to tell him that if the plane went down, a head wound would be the least of his worries. God, he couldn't handle the stress of a plane flight. This was a mistake. I should have fought harder, argued, swayed someone to get Jude off this op. Back at HQ, the thought of having to bring him along to search for Liam had been frustrating, an annoying dose of reality to swallow. But now? Now I was just scared. How was he going to handle the pressure of escaping Rob and Beta Team if he couldn't sit still for 5 minutes? If his imagination had already stolen his courage and had made a run for it? "Maybe I can find a way to leave him with Barton," I thought, rubbing my forehead. The problem was, how did I know that Barton wasn't one of the agents who sided with Rob in arguing for attacking the camps? How did I know that any of his teammates wouldn't gladly put a bullet in Jude's skull, neat and easy? "This is going to be great! It's going to be so cool!" Jude's op folder was stained with specks of whatever he had eaten for dinner the night before, and he was looking a little soft around the edges. I wanted to scream. Scream! It was another mouth to feed and another back to protect. Jude was the living embodiment of a distraction. But what was the alternative here? Sending him back to that hellhole, hoping he'd still be there, alive, when I got back and Cole put his plan in action? No. Jude was dead weight, one I was going to have to carry on my shoulders the whole way. But I was stronger now. I could do it. I'd find Liam, and I'd keep both of them safe, because that was the only option. That was the only one I was willing to accept. "Bartlett, what do you think he does?" Jude asked. The pages fanned under his fingers. "I recognize the other names. Frances is nice. She gave me a candy bar once. I like Labrowski and Gold and Philman, too. Cool guys. They taught me how to play solitaire. And I like Leader, too. I'm glad Barton got promoted. But who the heck is Bartlett?" "Don't know. Don't care," I said, focused squarely on the medical crates in front of me. Actually, I did know who Bartlett was, some new guy who transferred in from the Georgia base of operations. I had overheard some of the green girls in the locker room talking about what a fine specimen he was, but they had spotted me and split before I could find out anything useful. Jude was humming now, one foot tapping out a frantic rhythm against the mats underfoot. The compass hanging around his neck had slipped out from under his jacket and was swinging in time with him. I don't think he had stopped moving the entire 5 hours we were in the air. "Bartlett got his training at West Point. Do you think that means he's good?" "If you have the personnel files in your folder memorized, why are you asking me?" "Because people are more than what a piece of paper or a computer file says about them. I don't really care that Bartlett's specialty is knife fighting. I mean, don't get me wrong, holy crap, but I'd rather know why he joined the league, what he thinks about that decision now, favorite food." At that, I turned to look at him, half amazed, half horrified. "You think his favorite food is more important than knowing his preferred method of killing you in a fight?" "Well, yeah, it kind of is." I couldn't stop myself, and I couldn't explain why anger flashed so fast and hot through me. "You want to know about Beta Team?" I could hear my heart hammering in my ears. "For the next 12 hours, they are the only 6 people who won't be trying to kill you. But they don't have to protect you, especially if it interferes with the op. So, follow Leader's orders and keep your damn head down. That is all you need to know."
"Jeez," Jude said, blinking. "Not every adult in the world is trying to bury us."
My tongue was trapped behind my clenched teeth. "You think killing you is the worst thing they could do to you?"
"I just want to know people," he explained. "What's wrong with that?"
"Well, sorry," I said. "Most of them won't want to know you."
"No, I mean..."
He waved his hands through the air, like that was going to unravel the mystery of whatever he was trying to say.
"It's just that nowadays people are so quick to boil you down to bare bones of info and upload you into a system, you know? And I think no one can ever really know another person unless you really pay attention."
He stopped, stretching his long neck out to glance around, but our minder for the op was busy playing a game of cards with Francis.
"Like, look at Rob. His file is perfect. He went to Harvard, was an Army Ranger, then an FBI agent for a while. He's 6 feet tall exactly and weighs 203 pounds. He knows how to use firearms and speaks decent Spanish. But that... nowhere in there is anything that hints at the fact that he..."
Jude trailed off.
"I don't want to just see someone's face. I want to know his shadow, too."
I don't think Jude had ever lost anyone before Blake. He had heard about agents killed on this mission or on that raid or in that explosion, but once you fully settle into the special brand of pain that comes with being separated from someone you know down to the marrow of his bones, you learn not to try.
"Yeah?"
I asked. "And do you know my shadow?" Jude looked away, down to where the heels of his comically large boots were bouncing against the mat.
No,
he said, so quiet it was almost lost to the thousands of miles of crystal blue air beneath us. Sometimes, I don't think I've even really seen your face. It didn't bother me. Feeling left my hands, but it was only because of the cold, not the ice that had somehow manifested between us in the span of a few seconds. My jaw only clenched to keep my teeth from shattering, not to bite back an ugly, frustrated noise. I didn't need to be liked, or wanted, or cared for. I didn't need friends, and I certainly didn't need the kid who once brought down the League's entire computer network, tripping over his own huge feet, trying to guilt me into being something I wasn't. I was fine. Just a little cold. I burrowed down just a little farther into my coat, watching him fidget out of the corner of my eye. He was wringing his hands red. Beta Team is a good group, I said finally. They'll treat you right as long as you follow their orders. Alpha doesn't give a damn, so try to make sure you're paired with another kid who can watch your back. Delta's run by Farbringer, and he likes kids. Yeah? Jude said, but the life had gone out of his voice. He was studying the stretch of black fabric clinging to his knees. Ruby, he said so softly I almost didn't hear him over the roar of the plane. Did Rob pick me for this op so he could kill me? I met Rob for the first time right after Kate had gotten me out of Thurmond. The two League agents had planned to rendezvous at an abandoned gas station, both bringing with them any kids they'd managed to free. He had claimed he couldn't get his batch of kids out, and had to escape alone to avoid being detected by the camp controllers. Kate, who was so tangled up in him, had believed it instantly. But one slip, one careless touch, and his mind had opened to mine. I had seen the truth of it. On the nights I didn't stay awake terrorized by thoughts of what had happened to Liam and Chubbs and Zoo and the girls I had left behind at Thurmond, Rob's memories came slithering in. I would see the hooded boy in the ground, his entire body convulsing as the agent shot him at point-blank range. I saw the girl's face, saw her lips move to beg for mercy, and the way the dumpster had rattled when Rob had thrown her body into it. And by the end, I would wake up feeling sick, not just for the loss of life, but because it had felt like I had killed them myself. Talk about knowing someone's shadow. Try being his shadow. I can't stop thinking about Blake. I think about him every day, all the time. We should have told someone, he said. Jarvin and the others would be kicked out. The League would go back to the way it was before all this happened. They're the bad ones. If you get rid of them... That wasn't always how infections worked. Sometimes the rot spread too far to be removed with one single cut. Rob and Jarvin and the others might only be a few of many. I was so tempted to tell him the truth then, everything Cole had told me. But panicking him just to make a point was by far the stupidest course. If this was going to work, he couldn't know what the plan was in advance. I couldn't give him any chance to slip up and give us away to Rob and the others. You'll be fine, I told him. I'll be there the entire time. He was shaking. I don't think he heard a single word that left my mouth. How could they do this? What did we ever do to hurt them? Why do they hate us that much? I closed my eyes at the sound of Rob's booming laugh cutting through the air. Why don't you try to sleep? I said. We're going to be flying for a few more hours. There's no reason we both have to be tired. Okay, he said. I just wish... You wish what? I asked. Can we keep talking instead? He confessed it to his knees, awkwardly drawing his feet onto his seat. You really can't stand sitting in silence, can you? I asked. It actually kills you a little bit, doesn't it? It was a long time before he replied, as if he were trying to prove me wrong. No, he said. It's just that I don't like the quiet. I don't like the things I hear there. Don't ask. Don't ask. Don't ask. Like What?
I hear them fighting, mostly, he whispered. I hear him screaming at her, and the way she used to cry. But I hear it through closed doors. My mom, she used to put me in her closet, you know, because his temper was better when I was out of sight. I don't remember what she sounded like normally. Just the way she sounded then.
I nodded. That happens to me sometimes.
Isn't that so weird? It's been like 8 years, and I hear them, and I think of how dark and tight it was, and it feels like I can't breathe. I hear them all the time, like they're chasing me, and I can't escape them, not ever. They won't let me go.
I knew he was exhausted, and I knew firsthand what exhaustion did to your mind. The tricks it played on you, just as your defenses were dropping one by one. Ghosts don't haunt people. Their memories do.
Will you talk until I fall asleep? Just until I fall asleep. And can you maybe never tell anyone about it? Like, ever?
Sure. I leaned my head back against the seat, wondering what on earth I could say to calm him down. There's this story I used to really like as a kid, I began quietly, just loud enough that he could hear it over the roar of the plane's engines, about these rabbits. Maybe you've heard it before? I started at the beginning. The escape. Fleeing through the forest, meeting a new danger at every turn, the desperation that came with trying to protect everyone when you could barely take care of yourself. The boy with the bottomless dark eyes. The betrayal. The fire. The smoke. And by the time I realized I had told him my own story, Jude was fast asleep, tucked firmly into dreams.
Here's the thing about places like Boston. No matter what they were before, no matter the look of the population, no matter what businesses had flourished once, no matter what great person was born there, the city that people knew was gone. It was the loved one you saw in a rearview mirror, growing smaller and smaller the more time and distance you put between you, until even its shape became unrecognizable. Red brick buildings remained firmly rooted in the ground, but their windows had been bashed in. The grass on the common was dead in patches, overgrown in others, and scorched to ruin where there had once been trees. Grand townhouses were locked and shuttered, ice and old snow clinging to their dark stones. There was a crowded lane open on each road for cars and bikes to inch their way down, but many of the old, overlapping streets were filled with makeshift tents and the people huddled inside of them. It was bizarre to see the bright, colorful bursts of old umbrellas and children's bedsheets propped up as makeshift shelters. Some of the worse-off folks were exposed to the freezing air with nothing more than a sleeping bag or a wall to lean against. I don't get it, Jude said, staring through the tinted windows.
None of the streetlights were on, but there were enough fires burning that we could see the scene, and the first flurries of snow, from the back of the ambulance a hospital had oh so helpfully exchanged for the Lita Corp supplies we had dropped off. A lot of people lost their homes and housing when the markets crashed, I said, trying to be patient with him. The government couldn't pay off its debt, and because of it, these people lost their jobs and couldn't afford to keep what they owned.
But if everyone, everywhere, is like this, why didn't the banks just let everyone stay where they were until things got better? Isn't there something we should do to help?
Because that's not the way the world works. Rob called from the driver's seat. Get used to it.
He was wearing a dark blue EMT uniform, and he seemed to relish his ability to flash the lights and sirens when people in the streets didn't move out of his way fast enough. Sitting up front with him was the one member of Beta Team who had been assigned to serve as support on our half of the op. His name was Reynolds, and I only had to take one look at Jude's face as Reynolds and Rob slapped each other's backs to know he had been one of the agents Jude had overheard plotting against us. The rest of Beta Team were three blocks ahead of us, all seven crammed into the back of an old pickup truck. They were dressed as protesters of some kind. Street clothes, ragged hair, Red Sox caps, jackets thick enough to hide the weapons tucked underneath.
This professor we were looking for lived in Cambridge, just over the Charles River. Harvard's medical school, where he was conducting his research, was happily situated in the middle of Boston proper. Rob had decided, in his questionable wisdom, to divide the op into a two-prong simultaneous assault. Beta Team would handle disabling the lab, and Jude and I would break into the target's house and pull him in for questioning. At least, that's what Rob thought. We backtracked to the Longfellow Bridge, crossing the river to the sound of Jude's eager questions about baseball, the river, what the sticky substance was on the floor of the ambulance, how we were getting home, until Barton finally buzzed the comms in our ears. This is leader in position, ready to commence op at 22:30. What is your status, Minder?
5 minutes out from the goose's nest,
Rob answered, and I felt the ambulance accelerate under me. My anxiety took that exact moment to wake up. I sat a little straighter, bringing my knees to my chest and wrapping my arms around them.
Are we connected to Homefront?
Homefront here, line is secure, tracking both units now. Okay to proceed at 22:30. Satellite feed shows minimum interference at target 2. Minder, we're showing considerable activity in your sector.
I'm not sure who was more disgusted to hear him referred to as Minder, Rob or me. He didn't have a team of kids like Kate, but anyone who supervised a freak kid on an op was slapped with that title.
There's a protest in the old man's yard,
Rob said. I looked up, scrambling on all fours to get to the back window. He was right. We were passing by the university's tree-lined park with its crisscrossing paths. Hundreds, maybe even thousands, of bodies clustered around a large bonfire, ignoring the sleet falling around them. Signs and drums littered the nearby patches of snow, the only thing between the protesters and the small ring of disgruntled police officers that had them surrounded. People seemed to be hovering at the edge of the small park, as if looking for a way to break through the line of uniforms and guns.
"What are they protesting?"
Jude whispered, his breath fogging up the glass. I didn't answer, just motioned for him to get down. I began counting the blocks we passed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The ambulance came to a shuddering stop a short distance away from the professor's pleasant little white house with a slanted gray slate roof. Rob unhooked his seatbelt and stood, stretching slightly as he climbed into the back.
"We're in position,"
he said, pressing a hand to his ear. I felt his eyes slide over to me, but I kept mine fixed firmly on Jude, who had started shaking again. "This kid is going to get himself killed," I thought, pinching the bridge of my nose.
"You have the all clear?"
said the agent monitoring the op at HQ.
"Goose egg is a go."
"Roger,"
Barton said, and Rob echoed him. He was looking a little ragged, a dark beard coming in along the edge of his square jaw, but Rob's eyes were alert. He tossed the boy the other EMT jacket and a cap, like that could hide the fact that Jude looked about 2 years younger than he actually was.
"Don't say a word, don't fidget, and follow my lead exactly, then get your ass back here," he told the boy.
Then, turning to me, he added,
"You know what to do?"
I met his dark eyes, straight on. "I do." Rob needed Jude to disable the house's alarm system and man the gurney to get the professor out on the chance that any neighbors got nosy and opened their curtains at the wrong moment. We were supposed to take him around the city in a long 15-minute lap so I could work him into a state of cooperation, then dump him back on a sidewalk, his memory erased of the encounter. If he proved to be too hard to crack, Rob had a safe house we could bring him to for more painful methods of persuasion, I guess. Rob opened the back door, letting in a freezing draft of air. He and Reynolds pulled the gurney down, along with a duffel bag. Jude was wringing his hands again. I grabbed his arm just before he jumped down after Rob. "Be careful." Jude gave me a little salute and clenched his teeth in a way that made me think he was trying for a reassuring smile, or trying not to puke all over himself.
"Later, Gator!"
The door slammed shut behind them. "In an hour, Sunflower."
In all of the wild daydreams I'd had about the day I'd finally pack it up and leave, none of them had come close to resembling this moment. I didn't expect to feel as calm as I did. The first time I had escaped from Kate and Rob, the fear had flamed up fast and true, moving my feet before my brain could catch up. I hadn't known where I was going or how I was going to get there. I had just run. It was only dumb luck that I had found Zoo and the others. I couldn't rely on luck this time. I didn't have time to feel afraid of what would happen if I were caught. The steady composure I felt made me feel so much stronger than any of the wild, raw emotions I had surrendered to in the gas station. I had something to accomplish, and people to protect, and no one, especially not Rob Meadows, was going to keep me from it so long as there was breath in my body. The porch light flipped on as the three of them passed under it. Jude threw one quick glance back over his shoulder at me, then disappeared around the side of the porch to the little power box that controlled the house's electricity. When the porch light switched off and Rob bent over the gold door lock, I shrugged out of the League's heavy black coat, pulling out a lighter and the Swiss Army knife I had stashed in one of the pockets and tucking them in my boots. Liam's old leather jacket wouldn't keep the cold out for long, but it didn't have a tracking device in it. I climbed up to the driver's seat and popped the door open. My boots had just landed in the snow when Jude came around the back of the ambulance.
"What are you?"
I bolted forward, clapping a hand over his mouth. His eyes went wide in panic until I pressed a finger to my lips. Jude was too confused to process what was happening. I had to take his wrist and drag him behind me, letting the ambulance's bulk block us from view.
"We're inside," came Rob's rough voice in my ear. "Status, leader?"
"On schedule, minder."
I glanced up at the street sign, Garfield Street, and tried to get my bearings. I had to put as much distance between Rob and us before he realized we were gone. I could outrun him on foot, but I couldn't outrun a car, especially not with Jude. If we could make it back to the protest, we might be able to lose him and Reynolds in the crowd. Rob wouldn't think to look for us in the one place we had a decent chance of being caught. He was a brute, and a vicious one at that, but he wasn't very imaginative. Jude panted beside me, looking slightly frazzled, but otherwise all right. The wind was knocking around his hat and tugging at mine. I pulled the black knit cap down snug over my ears, trapping my loose long hair and muffling sounds from both prongs of the op. The cold was like nothing I had ever felt in Virginia. It was sharp, a persistent clawing at every bare inch of skin. I tried picking up my pace into a faster run, blinking back the tears and snow flurries, but Jude was struggling to keep up as it was. Patches of ice snapped underfoot, branches hidden beneath the old snow crushed as I trampled through the trees separating the houses and buildings. South. 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 I just needed to keep heading south and I'd find Harvard Yard and the protesters and escape.
"Target acquired. Tangerine, is the perimeter clear?"
Jude jerked toward me in wild fear, but I shook my head in warning. Rob's voice went down my spine like a match against a matchbook. The fire it lit was small, but it was burning through the tight control I had over my voice.
"Oh, yeah,"
I said after I pressed a finger to my comm. "The coast is all clear." I knew the moment Rob opened the ambulance door, the very second he found us gone. His end of the line went silent, even as HQ and Barton were requesting status updates from him. I could see his face in my mind, white, rapidly turning purple with the effort to hold back his fury. A small smile curved the corners of my mouth. He couldn't call out for me without revealing that he had lost me in the first place. A minder's job, above anything else, was to mind the freaks under his care.
"Tang,"
Reynolds began to say, only to be sharply cut off. "Hey, Rob," I said in a low, even voice. I saw the light from the bonfire in the yard, the new orange hue of the sky. Jude caught the back of my jacket, his long fingers twisting in the leather as he struggled to keep up with me. Snow was falling harder now. I pulled the hood of the fleece I was wearing under my jacket up over my head, stuffed my hands into my pockets, and crossed the last street.
"I got a question for you."
"Rue,"
Jude whispered.
What are we doing? Where are we going?
Tangerine, keep all non-op transmissions off the line, came Barton's voice.
Good. I wanted him to hear. I wanted all of them to hear this.
The ring of police and National Guardsmen had been busted open, and the protesters gathered there were streaming past them, signs clutched in their hands, drums beating. A midnight march, I guess, though I had no idea for what. And judging by the variety of signs I saw, they weren't really sure what they were protesting either. The draft that forced them into PSF service? President Gray's unwillingness to negotiate with the West Coast government? The general state of awfulness spreading like poison over the entire country as the pollution had over Los Angeles? Most of the faces around us were young, but not teenagers. A good portion of the country's universities and colleges had been temporarily shut down due to lack of funding, but if a few still had money left, I guess Harvard would have been one of them. "We are your tired, your poor, your huddled masses," read the sign next to me. I let them get ahead of us, trailing far enough behind that the others had less of a chance of hearing the chanting over the comm. I waited until they had cleared out of the square, before touching the comm again to activate the microphone.
I just want to know. What were their names?
Tangerine?
Rob's voice was tight, and he sounded slightly breathless.
I have no idea. Tangerine? Cease?
The woman at HQ didn't sound particularly happy with me either.
What the hell is going on, Minder?
Barton was still listening, too.
Those two kids you took out of that camp, the night before we met?
I said, keeping my eyes straight ahead on a young guy with dreadlocks waving us all forward.
The boy and the girl, I'm sure you remember them. It must have taken a lot of effort to get them out, never mind to tie their hands and feet that way.
Jude stared at me, his dark brows drawn together in confusion.
It doesn't make any sense to me. You got them out. And then you killed them in that alley and left them there. Why? What was the point? What did they say or do to make you so angry? That girl was begging you. She didn't want to die, but you took her out of that camp and you executed her. You didn't even take that boy's mask off.
I clenched my fists to get them to stop shaking, and in that brief second, suddenly it was Albin's voice crackling in my ear.
What's all this?
He took a deep breath.
I need you both to meet Leader. If you don't want to return to HQ with Minder...
We're not coming back to HQ, I said, until he's gone forever. It was a dangerous play. If Albin took the bait and booted Rob, there was still a good chance that others in his bloodthirsty pack would retaliate against the kids at HQ. But... Now that Albin knew Rob was hostile, he and the agents we could trust would be on the lookout for more of that attitude, at least for the next few weeks. Jarvin and the other conspirators would feel safer knowing that Jude was away and couldn't rat them out. And I didn't need forever. A few weeks and I would be back with all we needed to force them out. Rob, listen, I just want to know their names. I want to know if you even bothered to ask before you killed them.
Do you think this is a game? Stop lying, goddammit! When I find you...
You better hope you never find me, I said, ice edging each word. I didn't even have to close my eyes to see that girl's face. I felt her walking beside me, her eyes open, forever fixed on the barrel of the gun and the hand that held it steady. Because what I'll do to you will be so much worse than a bullet in the skull. I didn't wait to hear the response to that. I yanked the comm out and dropped it, letting the feet behind me smash it and scatter the pieces. I motioned for Jude to follow me as I jogged to catch up to the protesters. We were swept into the flood of people pouring down Massachusetts Avenue's wide berth. I was being jostled from all sides. Arms were being thrust around. People were yelling and screaming. And it was the safest I had been in months. I threw a glance behind me as I surged forward, looking for Jude's pale face. There he was, eyes wide, cheeks and nose pink with the blistering cold. I was coasting on a wave of simmering power and control.
I had gotten us away, and now no one was even looking at us. I felt Jude grab the back of my jacket again and guide us forward, flowing with the crowd. The drums up ahead rattled to life with a frantic rhythm, and for the first time, I felt a twinge of panic. I thought I heard someone calling my name behind me, but even the chanting was drowned out by the fury gripping my mind. The crowd around me was still growing, and the farther they moved down the street, the more they seemed to work themselves into a frenzy of excitement. The same chant was singing through their blood. More, 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 more. That was the only thing they had in common. The only thing they all wanted. More food, more freedom, more money, more. I realized where we were headed almost immediately, back into the heart of Boston. The Massachusetts Avenue Bridge was up ahead, and so were the familiar blue and red flashing lights of the police cars that were blockading it. The protesters didn't stop. There were dozens of policemen in riot gear, National Guardsmen taking aim, and not a single one of the protesters stopped marching forward. I felt my feet slow and was shoved forward by the momentum of the crushing wave behind me. The policeman in the center of all this, a grisly old man staring the rest of us down, held up a megaphone.
"This is Sergeant Bowers of the Boston Police Department. You are trespassing in violation of Mass General Law, Chapter 266, Section 120, and are subject to arrest. You are unlawfully assembled. I demand you immediately and peacefully disperse. If you do not immediately and peacefully disperse, you will be arrested. This is your only warning."
I didn't see the first stone that was thrown. I didn't even see the second or the third. But I heard the clatter of their impact against the clear shields of the riot police.
"Fire, then!"
someone was yelling.
"Fire! Fire! Fire!"
The girls around me picked up the word and began screaming it.
"Shoot! Shoot! Shoot!"
was the only rival to the chant. I took a step back, elbowing my way through the crowd's throbbing crush. They wanted the police to open fire on them? To make a point, or to capture it on video? I saw the handheld devices clutched in their stiff, frozen fingers. The snowflakes clung to the camera's glassy eyes, following the path of every rock, snowball, and brick that was launched toward the men and women in uniforms. I ducked, holding my arms over my head as I fought my way to the back of the herd. A stray elbow nailed the back of my head, and it was enough to knock me out of my haze. I reached behind me, grabbing Jude's arm as I turned. But the person holding my jacket was a short Asian girl with thick black glasses, who seemed just as startled to see me as I was to see her.
"Sorry," she shouted. "I thought you were my friend."
"Damn it!" I whirled around, scanning the nearby crowd. "Where is he?" The gunshot was the only thing sharp enough to cut through the chanting, the only thing strong enough to silence them. The girl and I both jumped back, but were roughly shoved aside by the people still marching forward behind us. Maybe the officer or soldier thought the threat of it would break up the crowd, but they had seriously misjudged the anger powering these people. The protesters at the head of the pack were clearly used to this kind of bullying. I glanced back over my shoulder. They were struggling against the clear shields blocking their paths, clamoring over the hoods of the police cars. The unlucky ones were yanked back and beaten into the ground by batons.
"Jude!"
I called, my guilt nearly cutting me down at the knees.
"Jude!"
The first can of tear gas released with a sinister hiss, but it wasn't enough to shift the crowd. They only launched themselves toward the officers at a run. I felt someone try to grab my arm and haul me back around to face it with him, but I yanked myself free. "Bad plan," I thought, choking on the poisoned air. "Bad, bad, bad plan, Ruby." It was dumb luck I even saw him then. I had started turning the other way only to catch a glimpse of a curly head of hair out of the very corner of my eye. The blue EMT jacket was flapping in the wind, one sleeve torn with a ragged edge. Jude was standing on his toes, one hand on the nearest streetlight to keep himself upright, the other curled around his mouth as he shouted,
"Ruby! Roo!"
over and over again. I saw now the way that fear fed anxiety and turned it into chaos. Jude's shape went out of sight, tucked into a cloud of tear gas, hidden behind the sudden stampede of bodies trying to get away from the guns, from the smoke, from the bridge. People were screaming, and the gunfire hadn't stopped. There were new noises, too. A helicopter hovering above us, casting a light down over us. The whirring of its blades drove some of the smoke away, clearing the way for the National Guardsmen to rush toward us. For the first time, I noticed more than one black uniform in the mix. If it had been a clear night, if my eyes weren't streaming with tears, if I could have heard anything other than the thrumming thunder of my own heart, I would have noticed it sooner. The air seemed to vibrate against my skin, and I caught the whiff of ozone a second too late to do something about it.
Jude, don't!
The line of streetlights along the stretch of road began to buzz, their orange lights bleaching to a molten white a second before they blew out together, sending a shower of glass and sparks down on the already terrified protesters. I'm not sure anyone recognized what Jude was, not until the lights from the nearby building switched on after months or years of darkness. I reached him half a second before the National Guardsman and his gun did, throwing my shoulder into his chest and driving us both to the ground. The impact blew the air from my lungs, but I scrambled up, shielding him from the butt of the soldier's rifle. With one blow, it cracked against my skull and sent me spinning into darkness. 7. The ground grumbled beneath my cheek, a low clattering that underscored the dull pain in my brain. Feeling was slow to come back to my limbs. I took a deep breath, trying to swallow the taste of iron and salt from my dry tongue. Matted hair stuck to my neck in clumps. I tried to reach up and brush it away, only to realize that my hands were trapped behind me, something sharp digging into the skin there. My shoulders ached as I twisted to readjust myself on the van's grimy floor. It was dark in the back, but every now and then a flash of light would come through the metal grating separating the front seats from the rest of the vehicle. Just enough for me to see that the uniformed driver and the man sitting in the passenger seat were dressed in black. Damn. My heartbeat was in my ears, but I didn't feel afraid. Not until I saw Jude sitting pin straight on one of the benches, his hands bound and his mouth gagged. While the PSFs had bound my hands, for whatever reason, probably because I was already unconscious, they hadn't used a gag on me, and I was grateful. Bile rose, burning the back of my throat, and the only way to make the whole thing worse would have been to choke on my own vomit. I could feel the anxiety in me building to a slow and steady beat of, not again, not again, I can't go back there, not again. Calm down, I ordered myself. You're no good like this. Get a grip. I couldn't get my jaw to move, to say something to get Jude's attention. It took several precious moments for him to notice that I was even awake, and when he did, his body gave a huge jerk of surprise. He tried in vain to rub the cloth out of his mouth with his shoulder. I shook my head. If we were going to do something, it would have to be quietly. Jude's fear was an actual living thing. It hovered over his shoulders, black, thunderous. He began to shake violently. He tossed his head, trying to draw desperate gulps of air into his lungs. He's having a panic attack. The thought was a quiet, sure one, and I was surprised by how much resolve it flooded into my veins. It's okay, I whispered, hoping the guys in front wouldn't hear me over the chatter of their radios. Jude, look at me. You have to calm down. He was shaking his head, and I could read his thoughts, clear as if I had actually been inside it.
I can't. Not here. Not now. Oh, God. Oh, God.
I'm here with you, I said, bringing my knees up close to my chest. It was painful, but I managed to drag my arms up around my legs, so my bound hands were in front of me. Take a breath through your nose. A deep one, I said. Let it out. You're all right. We'll be fine. You just need to calm down. And he needed to do it sooner rather than later. My mind was going in circles, trying to think of where the nearest camp was. Upstate New York?
Wasn't there one in Delaware, out near a whole town of abandoned farmland? Where were we now? I held Jude's gaze with mine. Calm down, I said. I need you to focus. You have to stop the car. You remember Saratoga? If there was only one good thing I could say about the League's methods of training, it was that the instructors were creative. They tended to have a supernatural sense of what kinds of situations we would find ourselves in, including a practice run-through of almost this exact scenario. In that simulation, Vida, Jude, and I had been on a make-believe op in Saratoga and had been taken hostage. Vida and I had fought our way out of the van and both ended up dead, shot in our escape. Instructor Fiore pointed out everything we should have done, which included Jude doing something other than cowering in the back of the car. I saw him take a deep breath and nod. When I had traveled with Zu, the biggest hurdle she had to overcome was controlling her yellow abilities. She had worn rubber gloves for the better part of our time together to avoid zapping machinery or the car, but we'd seen her lose control twice without them to block her charged touch. Jude, though, he'd been trained. He'd had the benefit of being around other yellows who were willing to help him learn. Although he ran at a speed that was 10 times faster than everyone around him, he kept his abilities in check. The scene out by the protest had been the first time I'd ever seen him slip, and in such a huge, horrible way. He closed his eyes, and I rolled over onto my knees, trying to brace myself. I felt the huge swell of electricity, felt it ripple along the hairs of my arms. It crackled in my ears, heated the air until it burned white. It was too much for the car's battery to take. The car didn't even shudder as it died. It was like it had slammed into an invisible wall. I went sliding toward the front grate with the force of it. The two PSFs cried out in confusion. But I didn't think it through. Cars on the East Coast were rare, with the sky-high prices of gas and the cost of upkeep. I had just assumed that there would be no one else out driving, that the van would stop and I would find a way to take the PSFs out one at a time. I saw the flood of white headlights at the same moment the PSFs did. The force of the impact as the semi-truck clipped the front of our van sent us spinning fast and wild. The airbags exploded with a scent like burning. I slammed into the bench opposite of Jude, who went tumbling to the floor. The van went onto its right tires, and for a split second I was sure we'd start rolling and that'd be the end of the story. Instead, the van slammed back down onto all fours. Over the hiss of the smoking engine and the cusses one of the PSFs was hollering, I heard the semi-truck's tires squeal as it slid to a stop. Flowers! Flowers! I shook my head, trying to clear my double vision as my hands felt along the ground for Jude. They didn't stop until they met with his bony, warm ankle, and I felt him twitch in response. Alive. It was too dark to see if he was in one piece. Flowers! God damn it! If it had been anyone else beside the PSFs, I might have felt sorry for the trouble we'd caused them. One of the men in uniform, Flowers, I guess, was slumped forward in his seat, his deflating airbag smeared with blood.
Shit!
The driver was pounding on the steering wheel. He felt around the crumpled dashboard until his fingers latched onto the radio. Jude had done his job, though. Anything electronic within 50 feet had been fried. The man kept trying to click it on, kept saying, "This is Moreno, do you read?" The PSF must have remembered protocol, because he reached over and forced the door open, jumping out into the snow. He'd have to secure us, make sure we were all right. I was ready for him. My legs were shaking like a foal's as I dove over Jude's prone form, beating the soldier to the door. He had his gun in one hand, but needed the other one free to unlatch the back door. I had my handcuffs looped over his neck and his face between my hands before he could let out a gasp of surprise. The soldier, Moreno, was rattled enough that his brain didn't put up much of a fight. Taking control was smooth, easy, without the slightest whimper of pain in my mind. "Take our handcuffs off," I ordered. I waited for him to reach up and do it before ripping the gun out of his hand. Jude let out a blissful moan as their metal grip released. "Turn around and start walking back toward Boston. Don't stop until you reach the Charles.
Understand?
My finger curled around the trigger of the gun.
Walk back toward Boston, he repeated. Don't stop until you hit the Charles.
I felt Jude at my back, swaying, but kept the black handgun trained on the PSF's head as he walked away, disappearing into the swirling clouds of snow, deep into the night. My arms began to shake, both from the frigid cold and the stress of keeping myself upright. The truck driver took his time, but he appeared at the driver's side window, pounding against it.
Is everyone all right? I've called for help.
I signaled for Jude to stay back. The PSF was still visible as he made his way down the highway, despite his dark uniform and the pitch-black road. The truck driver spotted him immediately. I counted off his steps as he ran after him, calling,
Hey! Where are you going? Hey!
At the sight of him, Jude slipped the cuffs from his shaking hands, and they clattered as they hit the floor. When the truck driver spun on his heel, I was already waiting for him, gun up, hands steady. The truck driver's face went stark white under his beard. For a moment, we did nothing but stare at each other, the snow collecting in his wiry hairs. His jacket was a vivid red plaid and matched the knit cap he had pulled down low over his ears. Slowly, he raised his hands in the air.
Kids,
he began, his voice shaking.
Oh my God, are you guys?
Jude's hand tightened around my shoulder.
Rue,
he began uncertainly. Get lost, I said, nodding toward the gun in my hands.
But the nearest town is miles away.
I saw the driver relax, his hands dropping back down to his sides now that the shock had worn off. Clearly, he thought I wasn't capable or willing to shoot him if it came down to it. I didn't know whether to be furious or grateful about it.
Where are you going to go? Do you need a ride? I don't have much food, but it'll be warm and...
Maybe the driver thought he was being kind. Jude obviously thought so. I barely caught the back of his jacket to keep him from jumping out of the van and throwing his arms around the man in weepy gratitude. Or maybe the driver just wanted the $10,000 per head he'd get for turning us over.
I need you to get lost, I said, switching off the gun's safety. Go.
I could tell that he wanted to say something else, but the words caught and stuck in his throat. The driver shook his head once, twice, and gave me a weak nod. Jude let out a strangled protest, lifting a hand in his direction like he could compel him to stop. The driver was slow to turn and slower to walk away.
What did you move that for? Jude cried. He was just trying to help.
The thin layer of ice on the road cracked as I jumped down, snapping me back to full alertness. I didn't have time for explanations, not when the need to run was singing through my veins. The night was long, and the piles of snow in the heavy woods around us unmarred. We would have to move fast and cover our tracks.
We help ourselves, I said, and led him into the dark.
The distant specks of headlights down the highway did nothing to ease up on the chill that had dug its fingers into my chest as we ran. I kept hoping to come across a car we could use, but every single one that had been abandoned on this stretch of road had a dead battery or no gas. 5 minutes of charging through the knee-deep snow of the nearby woods, following the edge of what I assumed was the Massachusetts Turnpike, finally turned up an exit sign for Newton, Massachusetts, and another one telling me it was 45 miles to Providence, Rhode Island. This was what I knew about the state of Rhode Island. It was south of Massachusetts. Therefore, we were going to Providence. And then I was going to look for a sign for Hartford, the only city I knew in Connecticut, and then one for New Jersey. And that was how my fourth grade education was going to get me down the eastern seaboard, at least until I found myself a goddamn map and a goddamn car.
Wait,
Jude sputtered, gasping for breath.
Wait.
We need to move faster, I warned. I'd been dragging him along behind me, but I'd carry him if I had to.
Hey!
He let his body go limp, dropping to his knees. I jerked back with the suddenness of it, almost losing my balance.
Come on, I snapped. Get up. No, he cried. Not until you tell me where the heck we're going. Barton's probably been searching for us all night.
The highway was lined on either side by hills and pockets of dense trees, but we were still far too exposed.
Every time a passing freight truck bathed us in white headlights, I had to steel myself all over again. I took a deep breath. "Do you have your panic button?" I asked. "Jude, look at me. Do you still have it?"
"Why?"
he asked, patting around his pants pockets. "I think so, but..." "Toss it." His thick brows were drawn together, the tip of his long nose red and running with cold. He used his free arm to swipe it against his coat.
"Ruby, what's going on? Please just talk to me."
"Toss it," I said. "We aren't going back to L.A. At least not yet."
"What?"
Jude sounded small, far away.
"Are you serious? We're ditching?"
"We are going back eventually," I said, "but we have another special op first. We need to keep going before someone comes looking for us."
"Who assigned it?"
Jude demanded.
"Kate?"
"Agent Stewart." Jude didn't look convinced, but I had him on his feet now. "I have to recover information from one of his sources," I explained, trying to make it sound as mysterious and dangerous as I could. And it worked. The nervous look he'd been wearing changed to one of interest, and a small fizzing excitement. "It's vital to the mission of the League, but I couldn't let Barton know the real reason for leaving. I had to figure out a way to make sure that Rob was gone by the time we get back."
"You should have told me," Jude said, "from the beginning. I could have handled it."
"It's classified. A need-to-know op," I said, adding, "a dangerous one."
"Then why the heck are you taking me?"
he asked. "Because if you go back now, they'll kill you, just like they killed Blake." I felt ashamed. The feeling snuck up on me, gripping me by the throat. I'd taken him without giving him any kind of choice, and then simplified the truth to make this reality go down that much easier. Hadn't I hated Kate for doing the exact same things to me? Had she felt as desperate to get me to agree as I did with Jude now? Jude slowed again, looking at me like he'd never seen me before.
"I was right," he whispered. "That is why he picked me. I was right."
"Yeah," I admitted. "You were." Jude nodded, working his jaw back and forth, trying to get the words out. Finally, he reached into his EMT jacket and pulled out the familiar black button, tossing it aside.
"It was dead anyway," he muttered, pulling back out of my grip. "I fried that car and everything in it, remember?"
"Right, of course. The trackers in his clothes would be dead too."
"All right,"
he said, his voice sounding stronger. This was the Jude I had been counting on. The one who thought all ops would be as cool as the video games he played with Blake and Nico. I reached over and brushed the snow powder from his hair and shoulders. "You have to follow what I say exactly, understand? We're going completely off the grid, and no one can know where we are. Not Kate, not Vida, not even Nico. If they find us and bring us in, we ruin every shot we have at this op, at making sure the League is a safe place." As quickly and simply as I could, I laid the op out for him. Everything, from where we were headed first to what Rob and the others had been planning. I gave him a sliver of the truth, that I had been traveling with Liam for a while, but we'd split up before Kate brought me in and I'd lost track of him. Would it really be so awful to just tell him the whole truth? I was surprised there was a part of me that was even tempted to talk about those last few precious moments in the safe house. It just didn't make sense to complicate everything by letting him into that moment of goodbye. I was the only one I wanted living in it, thinking about it, dreaming of it. And, to be honest, I needed him to trust me absolutely now, more than he ever had, if this was going to work. If I told him what I had done to Liam, every look Jude would give me from that moment on would be tainted by the fear I could do it to him, too. If he could even bring himself to look at me at all. This was the kid who had sat with me for every meal when half of the League was too afraid to look me in the eye. He didn't flinch when I touched him. He waited for me to get back from ops to make sure I was safe. As annoying as it had seemed to me then, I'd never thought about what it would be like to lose it. Him.
Jude listened to it all, strangely calm for him. He didn't react at all when I told him what was on the flash drive Liam was carrying. At first, I thought he had stopped paying attention, but at the end of